This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Tonight I have great pleasure in introducing Dr. Michael Joffe as our main speaker. Michael is reader in the School of Public Health at Imperial College London and has crossed the disciplinary boundaries from epidemiology and biostatistics into economics, with a strong institutionalist flavour, I think. He told me that he was both professor and student at the same time, some 12 years ago, was it? Seven years ago?
Yes,
12 years ago. He took a master's in economics while continuing to operate as an epidemiologist. As you may have seen from the website, he has published in the Cambridge Journal of Economics on economic growth, and I believe his presentation today will take that paper as a starting point, but it represents his current work in progress. We're also very fortunate to have as our principal discussant Dr. Gemario Impoliti, who lectures on economic growth and international trade in the Faculty of Economics here at Cambridge. I understand he took his PhD at the New School in New York, so he's no doubt familiar and I trust comfortable with approaches to economics other than the standard model. And you're both most welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Mark, for the invitation. I'm very happy to be here talking to you this evening. As you've just been told, this paper came out a short while ago in the Cambridge Journal of Economics, The Root Cause of Economic Growth Under Capitalism. And it's a largely conceptual, historical and institutional analysis of why capitalist growth occurs, or why sustained per capita growth really only occurs in the form it does, that we're familiar with in modern society, under a capitalist system, a successful capitalist system. I will not be spending a lot of time on that actual paper. The paper also does contain a kind of verbal model of how I think the thing works, and I'll be talking a bit about that. But I'll also be talking about some other work, and I'm going to be talking about some fairly new ideas of mine. Well, they're not that new ideas, but I've been developing them fairly recently. Partly, you know, as with any published paper, it represents what one was thinking two or three years ago, 3 years in the case of this paper. So if I was presenting just that, I would probably fall asleep halfway through because it's all old stuff. So this is new ideas, which means I'm really keen to get criticisms, comments, questions, and particularly critical ones. They're the ones that are the most useful. So I'll look forward to that at the end. Without more ado, I'll just carry on with talking about this. Can people hear me all right sitting down? It's quite good acoustics here, I think. Okay, so I'm basically... this is what I'm going to be talking about. Really quite a short introduction about what the current discourse is. Then the two major sections of those, and then just a few slides to conclude. So the current discourse, a large part of what economists talk about, economic theory, is about the market in some sense. And the idea is that there is a thing called the market and has particular sets of properties of which convergence towards a stable equilibrium is very prominent, and there are also other things that you know about if you've ever done an elementary economics course, which I'm assuming you have. And an observation which is not new to me is that this market idea doesn't actually describe the world in which we work awfully well, or at least there are quite a lot of phenomena that don't fall within it. And there are various particular things. Obviously, in the last few years, bubbles and crises have become really center stage. They weren't very much studied in the last century, shall we say, but or less so, but there's a lot of attention now. And this property that my CJE paper is about, that capitalism has the property that it grows. actually, it's so familiar that people actually don't seem to talk about it very much, but it is quite central to what I'm saying. So I'll say a little bit about that. And if you want more about that, we can discuss it, or you can read my paper. The conventional view, obviously, about growth, the neoclassical view, is exogenous technical change. And some people go back to Adam Smith and talk about his theory of growth. Although a large proportion of economic historians tend to see Smithian growth as actually really rather different, or quite different from the modern type of growth. And I do assume that in the model that I'm talking about. Now, my problem with the current discourse is that they're either just reacting to the assumptions, so assumption of perfect competition, assumption of rationality or something like that. People in reactive mode just saying, well, that's not true of the real world. I'm not really very interested in that. More important is the idea of market failure, and there are these various kinds of market failure, very familiar with these. The idea of failure means, well, the market model is okay, but the real world deviates for one of these reasons, which leaves the theory itself as being okay, that the whole convergent idea still holds. And what that leads to, this whole discourse leads to a discourse which I think is predominant in large areas of economics, may not be the whole of it, of the market as against the state. And people tend to take their view on the rights and wrongs according to political values, which I think is very undesirable from a methodological point of view. I think as economists, we ought to be able to do better than that. Okay, so I'm going to be talking about types of markets. It can mean a lot of different things, some of them quite trivial, place, time, and so on. Obviously, the ideal types of textbook theory that everybody's familiar with. Also, markets for different types of goods, which actually is related to what I'll be talking about to an extent, but I don't explore that in this presentation. That's for further work. And then if you Google types of market, you get various kind of ad hoc sort of breakdowns of it without any particular logic to it or structure, but just recognizing that there are markets of different kinds, but this typically isn't analyzed. So what I'm going to do is say, well, actually, there are different types of market that are radically different dynamically, that one can understand in what ways they're different, and that this can be modeled. And I'm going to choose two kinds of example, this one won't be familiar to you, probably, cost-tethered markets, but I'll explain that in a moment. And then secondly, cost competition. So that's in the real economy, competition between firms. And then I'm going to talk about free-floating markets. You'll see what I mean as I go along. So to start with, the competition between firms in the real economy. A lot of what I'm talking about today is the setting of prices, but it's not just the setting of prices, it's what's behind the setting of prices. So in the real economy, goods and services, the prices are set in relation to costs. How does that happen? Well, there are various accounts of this, but you can take quite a conventional view on price setting that it's all about supply and demand, and I don't dissent from that. I think that's fine. But what actually happens is that as competition operates, the prices get driven down. If they get driven down below unit cost for any length of time, then that product line or that firm just disappears. So what you have is a real economy in which the prices are above unit costs, and usually not that far above unit costs, because competition ensures that they can't get very much above unit cost unless there's monopoly or something like that. But in most sectors there's some competition, and so there's a relationship between, as I say, prices and competition. And this is just the familiar market model. You know, prices go down, the quantity goes up. If there's a boom in quantity, then the price goes up, and so on. The same thing on the supply side. That means with the delay, increased price brings more suppliers into the market, increases investment, and so on. So nothing unconventional about this, except you're probably more used to the sort of Marshallian thing, which I'll use a bit later, rather than a systems diagram, but I think this is a nice way, and I'll be building on this as we go along. So anyway, as I said, competition tends to drive the price down, so we add competition in there, and then in addition to that, as I said, costs limit how low prices can go, so costs and prices are related. And so what I am saying is that the prices end up just above unit costs. I already said that. I call this cost tethering, so that's what I mean by cost tethered. And that's going to be a contrast with the second half of my talk, which is about free-floating markets, which are not cost tethered. And I think this is a very important distinction, but it doesn't seem to occur anywhere in the literature. Maybe it does, I've just missed it, but I've had discussions of this kind before. So if people either are familiar with this or would like to criticize it, I would be very interested in that. By saying that something's tethered to cost, I'm not saying there is like a fixed market, a fixed markup or whatever. In fact, it's really important that the markup is variable. But it does give some kind of, it's not quite like Adam Smith's natural price, but it gives some kind of order of magnitude of what the price is likely to be. Okay, so coming back to this, just to analyze it very briefly and superficially as a system, it's a system with, as you can readily see, negative feedback, and it will tend to move towards a stable equilibrium, which is what everybody knows, and it's what the Marshall diagram is about as well, but I just think this is a more dynamic way of expressing it. These express the endogenous causation, endogenous causal processes of the system, but you can obviously have shocks as well. You can have a supply shock, you can have a demand shock, and so just to summarize this, this system is static in the sense it has time-dependent processes, but the endogenous process is always towards a stable equilibrium. And neoclassical economics, when it talks about time, is often talking about time to adjust, and that's what this is about. And I'm going to be talking about systems in which this is not the case. But before I do that, I'm going to introduce a second firm. So this firm's competing now. This is not duopoly. Just two firms, because it's easier to see what's going on. They have the same intensity of competition, obviously, because they're competing with each other, and the rest is just mirror image. Price competition, which is not, you know, it occurs, but it's not terribly important. Company A reduced its price. The amount that company B is, its product is demanded goes down, so in response, it reduces its price, so A then has less demand for its product, and so on. And so this is a positive feedback loop. But because of cost tethering, it can't go below unit costs for any length of time, or they'll just disappear. Okay, so far I've assumed costs as given, which is a conventional assumption, as you know, in mainstream theory. But what happens if costs can be reduced? And this is really where it becomes quite interesting. So this is a subset within cost-tethered markets. Now, we're going to be talking about on a longer timescale, because up until now I've been implicitly talking about fairly short-scale dynamics. But if costs can be reduced, this is obviously, you know, investment and so on. So it's on a much longer timescale. So everything I'm going to say from now on is on a long time scale, but it's the same diagram. So now if company A cuts its price, then and B finds its demand going down, well, it may invest to reduce its cost. And then it can reduce its price as well, which means A has to respond. And this is also a positive feedback loop, but now over a longer time, as I said, and what's actually happening here in terms of a Marshallian diagram is cost competition. Yes, that each of these can be regarded as an investment period, if you like, every 5 years or something. I've portrayed it as much more regular than it is in the real world, but this is just schematically saying what cost competition is about. So now this is the bit where I talk about what's in the paper, and I'm just going to skate over this, but we can go back to these things if you want. The process I've just been describing, where firms can actually reduce their costs, this is a characteristic of the capitalist firm, which is, I think, a fairly well-known concept. I'm using it in the same sense as Jeff Hodgson wrote about it a long time ago, in, I think, 1990s. About 15 years ago, he was writing about this. Which means a capitalist firm controls the means of production and employs wage labour. There are other bits that can go into this definition, but these are what's essential from my point of view in terms of my concept of how this works. What it means is, well, if you've got a firm that can employ wage labour, then if your firm is successful, you can expand it, you can take on more. If it's unsuccessful, then you can lay workers off. If you need to, you can possibly close a factory in this country and open one in China. So basically, control of the means of production, employment of wage labour, gives individual firms a lot of flexibility in the inputs they can call upon, and also the size of the market. Because if I contrast this with, for example, pre-capitalist firm of somebody who grows a particular crop, say onions, or a watchmaker, somebody who repairs shoes, but it's a small firm, it's a family firm, maybe, you know, the old guild system, a journeyman or something like that, but it's small scale. So if the firm is really successful, if you grow really good onions really cheaply, there's a limit to how much you can expand that business, or with your shoe repairing or shoemaking firm, it's limited by what you can do. So I'm now talking about the capitalist firm can readily introduce new technology and production methods because they just own and control the methods of the means of production, and similarly new products, because obviously new products require you to have control of the means of production. Well, they don't require it, but it's much easier in the real economy. Somewhat different in the new e-economy, but that's sort of special, going off at a tangent, really, a special subject. So the conclusion I come to in the paper is that far from being a market economy, which is what is the conventional view of capitalism, capitalist real economy, I'm still talking just about real economy. It's not a market economy, it's a hybrid economy. It's market relations, but between firms. And firms are authority structures which can keep pressures downwards on costs and also introduce innovations more generally. And this is what's specific about capitalism. And in the paper, I talk about the historical justification for that that view. Now, what's this got to do with growth? Well, if costs go down, I'm talking about real costs, unit costs, for the same output, then another way of expressing that, if you keep the input the same, then the output grows. In other words, if you can produce one of these chairs in a day, and then you introduce a new process and you can produce in half a day, well then, but if you still keep working for a day, then you produce two chairs in the same time. It's that's all I'm saying there, nothing very subtle. So that's the case I'm making is that that's the main and original source of growth within capitalism, and that has other effects, makes societies more prosperous, and then there's a market for new and better quality products. I'm really rushing over that argument here. But I'm not denying the importance of new and better quality products, but I am saying that you need the buying power. You have to have the market for these to be introduced, and that's what happens as capitalism gets richer in any particular place. And so these together account for what I call the dynamism of capitalism, or capitalism when it's successful. And this quote from Baumol: capitalism is unique in the extraordinary growth record it has been able to achieve. I think Baumol, who's quite a conventional economist, is absolutely right about that. This is from his book, The free enterprise miracle or something, was it? Anyway, something like that. The free market miracle machine?
Engine, the free market, yeah, can't engine on growth.
Yes, something. Anyway, so for a start, in the title he equates it with the free market, which I think is historically false. And he then goes on in that same book to produce a model which is actually only specific to very restricted periods and locations of capitalism, which is, I don't know if you're familiar with this book, but it's about oligopoly and formal research and development and so on. So it actually doesn't do justice to his original historical observation. That's my view anyway. And other people have made this observation before as well. Another one is Deirdre McCloskey in her book last year, Bourgeois Dignity, and she talks about it as a hockey stick. We can come back to that if you're interested, but to sum up this half of the talk, the structure of my argument is there's an institutional change which is real in the real economy of capitalism, which is the capitalist firm, as I described it, that produces a system with its own characteristics, which was this figure of eight thing, with its own endogenous causal processes. And this is all verbal up till now, but you can model this in various ways. This is just in terms of differential equations. I won't spend a lot of time on this, but the tour here represents annual expenditure to reduce costs in the future. In other words, real investment. The kappa is the constraints on your own company's expenditure. Rho is the response of one company to another. It was this cross bit there that in my diagram. And the alphas just represent animal spirits. And this is the change in the investment, and this is Richardson's arms race model. So this is an arms race, and it's identical actually to Richardson's model of real arms races, in other words, government's expenditure on armaments, except I've got investment by firms instead. And it's very simple with that starting point to show that if the constraint on the own firm expenditure, the product of those for the two firms, is greater than the response coefficients, then it's convergent to this stable equilibrium, so there's no arms race. But if the reverse is the case, then you get this, which is that both companies have to continue to invest in cost-cutting machinery or efficiency or barcodes or whatever it happens to be. But this is the constant pressure on companies to reduce their costs, and you can get an arms race in those conditions. And I've also modeled this in system dynamics. There's many ways one can model this. I could do agent-based modeling, which is what I'm planning to do next week, start on that, but I haven't quite got around to it yet. Basically, this is just a similar model. It's not identical to the one I just showed you mathematically, but it's the same idea. And I'm going to show you just quickly a baseline run in black, in which is just nothing happens. Two identical companies. I then introduce a 10% fall in costs into company A just to get something started, because there's no animal spirits in this model. Basically, it plays the same role as that. And then there are three kind of proper runs. The blue line is what I'm calling pre-capitalist economy. In other words, the companies can't reduce their costs, so they just have this introduced 10% fall in costs, but they can't reduce the costts after that. Then there's competition between one firm that's like that and a capitalist firm that can reduce costs. And then finally, the green line is where both firms can do that. And for company A, what you find is that it started off at 50, and then the 10% increase in productivity is that drop there. And if you follow the blue line, it's horizontal. Nothing happens because nobody can respond to it. if in the red line where company A can respond, company B can't, then A's costs go down a bit, prices go down a bit. The scales are a bit haywire on this, but it's just a rough thing. The profit and the market share for A increase, so it's kind of, but it stabilizes. But what then happens if both firms can reduce costs, and this is the interesting bit, is, well, A still has the first mover advantage, but the important bit is this fall in unit costs and in prices, which is greater than the magnitude of the original productivity that I introduced, and however long you pursue this, it's going to go on. In other words, that's an arms race that will continue. And firm B is just the same, but in reverse. In other words, firm B also has reduction in unit costs and in prices, but it has the disadvantage of the mirror image of firm A's first mover advantage. So that's all on that real economy bit, and I'm now going to talk about something completely different, which is free-floating markets, where there's no cost tethering. And the sorts of markets I'm talking about here, the price is set only on what the potential buyer and seller can agree on, and the sorts of examples I'm thinking of are, first of all, in the financial sector, stock market and so on. Also collectibles, there was this paper 30 years ago or something by Baumol again, about the art market. There's no natural price that's just above unit cost as in the previous case, and so the price actually depends on a number of things, but it's highly dependent on what information is available, which explains the very important role that information has in economics, but particularly in these markets that are not cost tethered. Now, what information is used? Well, any number of different sorts of things, but empirically, I think there's a lot of agreement that there's huge evidence that trend extrapolation is one of the things that commonly occurs. And I'm just going to assume that this can occur. I'm not going to show you the evidence. Some of you may actually be familiar with it, more familiar than I am with the actual empirical evidence. So anyway, I talked about the financial sector in the last slide, and you could say, well, those are capital markets. Other kind of free-floating markets are, one is real estate. It's a bit different because there is a kind of, in a property boom, it stimulates new construction, and then, you know, buildings are left empty, currently happening, I believe, in Shanghai and Beijing, but 21 years ago in Japan, and it's familiar enough from our own experience as well. So property booms have this kind of cyclical pattern, which in system terms is actually a negative feedback with delay, but can have positive feedback spurts in it. Markets in commodities are a bit different. Things like minerals, like the copper price, some years ago, about 10 years ago, was it? The coffee price had a similar thing, where if there's an increase in price, well, suddenly there'll be they'll open a lot more copper mines or plant a lot of coffee trees and so on. So there is such a thing as unit costs, but these adjust slowly in response to price changes. So the futures markets are free-floating, the commodity markets are a bit more complicated. So this needs to be dissected in a bit more subtlety than I'm doing today, because I'm short of time and I haven't quite completed this analysis yet in a formal sense. Interestingly enough, whereas the financial markets and capital markets, these two could both be grouped together as land, and I'll come back to that at the end, in the conclusion, but let's just talk about bubbles. The arms race I talked about before, this figure of eight thing, is a form of positive feedback. Now, it's not in any way new to say that bubbles involve positive feedback, because the self-fulfilling prophecy is exactly a positive feedback mechanism. People like Robert Shiller and so on talk about feedback in this context. How much longer have I got?
Another 15.
Okay. So I'm going to go quite quickly through this. So I'm not claiming this is new, but I'm just saying this is another form of positive feedback contrasting with the negative feedback of the original market mechanism I showed you right at the beginning. So I'm going to show you a model of a bubble which I think is quite interesting, and I can't believe nobody's done this before because it's almost breathtakingly obvious. But anyway, I'll just go through it briefly. This is a very straightforward model which I'm sure you're very familiar with. The B and D are positive. It's just that in equations, and then if you add on to that the trend extrapolation condition which I talked about before, well, it means that you're adding to the price now an increment delta P which can be positive or negative depending on whether the trend is perceived as going up and likely to go up in the future, or going down and likely to continue going down. And that I just express that by theta. Theta depends on, it's a function of the trend, obviously, because that's what trend extrapolation means. I'm just saying it's linear, and this is still symmetrical. Theta can be negative if it's a decreasing trend, or positive if it's an increasing trend. I'm not assuming that theta is constant. The simple model, I just call it theta, but in any application, you would allow theta to vary in response to new information. And there's also a literature about investor sentiment and things like that, which I'm not going to go into today, but I have some slides which are not part of the presentation if people want to talk about rationality as against emotion and this kind of stuff. But I'm not assuming emotion or a strong form of groupthink. This is compatible with a sort of weak form of rationality. These, by the way, are mathematicians who published a paper 20 years ago which is quite prominent in the behavioral economics literature. Vernon Smith and people like that like that their model very much, which is why I picked them out. Okay, so coming back to this model, so what this is doing in adding theta, I'm going to press that, is doing that. And basically what, if you then compare the original equations 1 or 2 here, the negative sign and the positive sign, to get a bubble basically you need that B minus M theta to become overall negative and D minus N theta to become overall negative, which means that is the condition for the, yes. So those are the two conditions for bubble on the demand and the supply side, which means that what you're actually doing now is if you start with that, the curves are doing that, and once they get to cross, well, when they get past the vertical is where I've got to now, is you get a bubble. So there's the bubble. Just a word on symmetry. Remember I said theta could be positive or negative, trend extrapolation could be an upwards or a downwards trend, but these conditions I have for a bubble, because all these are positive, then the model predicts that bubbles only occur in a rising market and not in a falling market. So in other words, it's an asymmetric model. And if you look at the theoretical literature on bubbles, most of the models in there actually are symmetric, so they assume they're not that different from fluctuations. Bubbles can be upwards or downwards. So this is different from that, and I think that's quite interesting. Anyway, just to finish on that, this is also about symmetry. I'll skip that. I've given you two conditions, but actually that's not what we want. We want a single one, and in fact it's where the curves cross where the bubble is the criterion for the bubble, and that's math, I mean, it's very simple maths algebraically to derive that. Okay, just to comment on that, because theta varies over time, I'm not saying that bubbles will progress in a kind of linear fashion, in other words, constant over time. I am saying it has to be upward because the model shows that, but it doesn't have to be constant. The point about predicting bubbles, obviously a lot of people are interested in that because if you could predict that, you'd make a lot of money at the point at which to get out of a bubble. All I can say is that as a bubble grows, and this is not specific to my model, I think it's kind of common ground between almost anybody who thinks about bubbles. As it grows, there's an affordability gap, and that together with new information are likely to determine when a bubble ends and why it ends. This is a fairly new... Yeah, that's fine. I've just got a few more slides after this. The model I've just showed you is really just something that occurred to me one rainy afternoon, and I haven't developed it to the point where I've worked out how to estimate parameters empirically or any of that sort of thing. In principle, that should be possible, but that's still work to be done. So that's the model of bubbles. And just to summarize that second half of the talk, a free-floating market plus trend extrapolation will lead to a bubble if those quantitative conditions are also met, the ones I showed you for theta, or the one I showed you for theta. So, just to conclude, what can we say about types of market more generally? Because I've talked about two types of market, and they don't exhaust the whole topic of the types of market. And in particular, the labour market is well known as having particular difficulties, shall we say, in relation to that Marshallian supply and demand thing, and the whole Keynesian tradition is based on a different interpretation of that from the assumption that markets necessarily always clear according to that convergent Marshallian property. So failure to clear unemployment is one issue. Another one, which is very kind of traditional, is the backward-leaning supply curve of labour. There are various empirical observations, one which I got interested in from my master's dissertation, actually, the observation that different industries have very different wage levels of wages, and that this is very hard to explain according to conventional theory. Other things like when minimum wage legislation is introduced, the standard model predicts, well, unemployment is bound to rise, but typically that doesn't happen. And it's led George Akerlof to say, well, wage setting is actually different from other markets and it has a large sociological component. So just summarising that briefly, none of that is new work to me. And it's probably none of it is new to you. But it's a way of saying there are different types of market. And what's interesting is I was talking about financial markets as capital, copper and coffee as land. And so this is land, it brings us back to land, labor and capital, which is the kind of 19th century idea of factors of production. And I just throw that out as something interesting that maybe that's significant in this other types of market more general discussion. And some people now regard technology as a factor of production. So one could say, well, let's look at the market for technology and innovation and those sorts of things. But I haven't actually worked on that. I'm just throwing that out as a kind of throwaway line. There are other special cases, healthcare provisions, particularly interesting because that also seems to have very different properties from the ordinary market. Some methodological observations. The market mechanism as a feedback system that leads to convergence. Well, that happens even if the players are not rational or optimizing. It's actually unnecessary. In fact, Adam Smith's original idea is, well, people can come to the market with all sorts of weird and wonderful asking prices or willingness to pay. But the point is that the market mechanism if the market clears, the pricing mechanism will start making them converge. So actually rationality or optimization are unnecessary in this feedback view. The point of this talk is to say, well, other types of market have not only negative feedback, but positive self-reinforcing properties, and I've talked about an arms race for growth, self-fulfilling prophecy for bubbles. This is all in line with the great systems dynamics theorist, Jay Forrester, who is not as well known as he should be, and he's still alive at the age of, I think, 101. I'm not sure exactly how old he is. And he pointed out a very long time ago that systems containing feedback loops that have their own, they have their own endogenous causal processes, which is what diagrams are that I showed you, and that makes them less sensitive to initial conditions than would otherwise be the case. They can also have exogenous causal processes, I showed you at the beginning. This insight is related to complexity and chaotic behavior, which people know about and is more fashionable. It's a sort of obverse. They're two sides of the same coin, but all part of systems theory. Just a few observations on prices. Pretty much everything I've been talking to you today is about what's behind price setting. Price setting is, I think, a weak point in neoclassical theory. We have this Russian story about tâtonnement, but it is really just a story. Nobody really pretends that happens. And it's actually quite difficult to say how prices are set in the neoclassical view, I think. And labour market is just an extreme version of that. And to finish, just two slides. Return to my starting point. The idea that there's just one kind of market has led to a distorted analysis, and in many ways, but in particular the topics I've been talking about. But it also means that people then get either into reactive modes about, well, you know, the market's not really competitive or whatever, or rely on market failure. And I'm not saying these things, market failure doesn't apply. Market failures, you know, there's some very good theory in there and it's well backed up. I'm saying that's not all that there is, because one shouldn't assume markets are always self-clearing or convergent even. So I've analysed different kinds of market system terms, showing they don't all converge towards a stable equilibrium. If one can dissect out these subcomponents in this way, then we can see which bits of the economy are responsible for growth, which bits are responsible for instability. I would give no prizes to you for guessing which those are, because I've told you. And the idea that the sort of end result of market of economics is to juxtapose the market on the one hand against the state is very crude, and it conceals the heterogeneity which I've been talking about, and that's it. Thank you very much for your attention, and if anybody wants to come back to me at any stage with comments, criticisms or questions, especially critical ones, then that's my email address.
Thank you very much, Michael.